You're listening to a podcast from DCT Audio. I'm Dave Thomas, and I've been producing audio content for over 10 years. Thank you for listening to this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. For several years now, the levels of mental health and well-being within the UK police have been in decline. Many will argue that this is a result of an ever-increasing workload, a reduction in capacity and experience, underfunding, and a perception that social and mainstream media proactively portray a negative narrative of law enforcement within the UK. Additionally, lenient sentencing, poor organisational practices, and the disproportionate time spent on officers under investigation have contributed to create a perfect storm. In this short series of podcasts, I will be looking at the rising trend of police officers taking their own lives. I will be speaking with a variety of people to put a spotlight on police suicide, the reasons behind it, and hopefully how we can halt its rise. Well, hello. This is the first podcast we've done in a good while with my good friend Richard Horton. How are you, Richard?
Thank you, Dave. Yeah, it has been a good long while since we've done any podcasting, but we've got something I think that's well worth talking about today.
Indeed, and you've been quite busy in the political sphere of Lancashire.
Yes, I've, since leaving police, well, as you know, first I've baked a lot of croissants for Sainsbury's, but I've just finished doing that, and now I'm working as a constituency caseworker for a local MP.
Brilliant. Well, I'm delighted to say that we're joined by former police officers, we're all former police officers, retired, by Michael Brown. And if you follow Michael on social media, in particular Twitter, you might know him as the mental health cop. Michael, hello.
Hello, good morning, gentlemen. How are you doing?
We're very well, thank you. Michael, maybe you just, for people that aren't aware of you or don't know of your background, you became a bit of a subject matter expert on the Mental Health Act, but just give us a quick overview of your service, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, sure. So I've just finished almost 27 years. You know, I was one of those kids who grew up wanting to be a cop, and I joined in 1998. I've basically been operational 24/7 most of my operational career. But as you hinted around my subject matter interest, I got involved in policy and practice and training work around mental health responses, mainly because my force had a controversial death in police custody. And I was at the time doing a bit of research on what we do in custody with people who are brought in who are mentally ill. As you both know, that if you know two more things than everybody else in policing, you're suddenly an expert. And I was given an exciting career development opportunity to work at headquarters, which, you know, it kind of set me on the way to being able to spend a lot of time really digging into this topic that I had become interested in. There's no doubt I was genuinely kind of obsessed about why things don't quite work and how the police view things. And crucially, of course, the law, because as a cop, I'm not clinically qualified and was never kind of looking at it from that sort of angle. And I got really interested in why we don't really get much training and, you know, why mental health professionals don't get much training either on the legal stuff. And within that, a lot of things go wrong where people think, you know, police can do things that, you know, common sense might tell you is necessary, but actually the law's not predicated necessarily on common sense. So within all of that, I just became interested and it became a career-long, you know, interest. And it got me to spend 5 years at the College of Policing. I was seconded from my force to the College of Policing to write national guidelines, basically based on my blog, if I'm honest. And eventually by 2014, the query was, can you turn your blog into guidance and come to the College of Policing and write some training packages that work with that? So I did that until 2019. And for the final 5 years of my service, I was back 24/7 doing, you know, critical incident, public order, firearms command.
Well, you mentioned your blog, and that very nicely brings me on to an article you wrote, I believe, in June of this year concerning police suicide. It's a topic that is really under the spotlight, I suppose, in the media, and for good reason. Just tell us a bit about the blog and some of the things that became apparent to you.
My angle of interest around policing and mental health was mainly around how the police respond to incidents involving members of the public who are mentally ill. But of course, you can't be interested in that for very long before you realise that actually, you know, as Peel said, the police are the public are the police. Some of the stuff that the police are responding to involves them responding to colleagues who are in crisis or in difficulty. I know colleagues that were detained under Section 136 when they were at a really difficult point. I know police officers who died by suicide. And as we've all seen this year in particular, there's been an awful lot of news coverage around police suicide and in different forces around the country. My perception certainly is, I don't know if you guys would agree, that the numbers seem to be accelerating. We don't really know whether they are, of course, because not all police forces actually record data about how many of their officers die by suicide. And that's one of the problems we've got in understanding the topic. But I was motivated to write the blog because of my perception that it's becoming more of an issue, but also because in the work that I did, especially when I was at the College of Policing, I did get involved formally in some work that was about police well-being, police mental health, and indeed police suicide. And so the blog's an attempt to just rattle through some of those points about, you know, we don't really know how much police suicide there is because of the recording problems and the national collation of those data. And it was also putting some stuff out there that I probably mentioned on the blog before, but I thought, you know, some of the things that police officers said to the mental health charity Mind back in about 2014, you know, what do we know about police mental health and suicide? What do we know about, for that matter, ambulance, fire, Coast Guard? And it turns out we don't know very much. There's not very much published research around it. So Mind then went and did some of their own. They ran online surveys. They ran focus groups. They did some one-to-one follow-up. And eventually there was a meeting I was at in London where the director of research for Mind presented their findings to a group of people. And it included a senior representative from police, fire and ambulance, as well as the others. The police stood out by a calendar mile as being different. The results coming back, the things being said by officers about the police were a good degree worse than the things that were being said, by example, from paramedics about the ambulance service or firefighters about the fire brigade. And as a consequence, you know, you really could see the fire and ambulance lead sort of nudging each other and saying, well, you know, we're not coming out of here with a great story to tell for our organisations, but at least we're not as bad as the police. 50% of police officers had said if they had a problem and they disclosed it to the line manager, they anticipated that the line manager would make it worse. Not that the line manager themselves personally would necessarily make it worse, but the organisational things that have to happen, whether it's occupational health referral or if my officer on my response team, for example, if I'm the sergeant, if they're telling me they've now got depression and they're seeing their GP, they're on medication, can they still hold a driving grade? Can they still carry a taser? Can they still work night shifts? And some officers had given examples of where the moment they disclosed that they were suffering from depression, their career had been altered for them by the organisation. 90% of officers said they wouldn't inform their line manager if they had an option. If they could keep it private and manage it privately, they would prefer that option because they feared career-altering, if indeed not life-altering, consequences of making the disclosure. But it led, you know, eventually to the Blue Line Programme, what they called their standard offer to bodies and organisations that they work with, of, you know, a helpline, literature that can be left in police stations and ambulance stations and so on. It led to various support networks kind of being offered up for the duration of the funding. And that was a route to get some support that doesn't have to go through a line manager or occupational health. It was a route to confidential support and advice. Final point on the blue light, but the thing that interested me about it when I was watching this unfold, we were seeing, you know, stories emerging on social media and on force internal networks, certainly in my own force, that was true, where somebody brave and kind enough to stand up and tell their story was saying how it was that they got themselves to a position where they were struggling with their mental health. And I couldn't help but notice that all of the stories were, if you like, predicated on either personal problems in their life, or it was a story about how all the violence and the death and the blood and the horror and the trauma that we see as police officers is what had affected somebody's mental health. Of course, we know for a fact that, you know, exposure to traumatic incidents can indeed have a really negative effect on some people's mental health, and for some, that becomes pathologizing. But what was absent the whole story was this stuff that had been hinted at in those percentage figures I've just given, which is that the organizational contribution to people's poor mental health was just totally missing from the story. It's almost as if the police organization has a neutral effect on all of this. And we know that's not true. And that kind of bothered me. So in the blog, I made a, you know, completely hypothetical example of Superintendent Senso has made life really, really difficult for officers who are struggling with their mental health by a really intransigent attitude towards what could be done to support people. Or officers saying, you know, I suffer from my mental health because my sergeant's a bully. Because we know most sergeants are not bullies. They're capable professional people who are trying to support their officers. But we know there are some. because, you know, we've seen them, we know the examples. And that kind of story was kind of absent. And it just meant that the whole thing for me lacked a complexity or a depth as to what exactly it is that contributes to organizational difficulties. We know from Preventing Future Death reports that some people who have died, coroners have said that the organizational response to police officer well-being was a contributing factor. So it was with all of that kind of washing around my head again in light of this year's really sad events that I thought a blog just pulling that all together might be helpful. And it seems to have been read a bit more than most of my blogs are these days. So it seems to have struck a chord.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a hell of a lot to unpick there, which we will attempt to do. Richard, is there anything you want to say before we move on?
What you say about the hidden nature and its right, from my anecdotal experience, while I was a response sergeant, in 5 years I had one officer come to me, but there were a good number of others where I had to have that sit-down talk with them, maybe another sergeant. Are things all right? And the initial is always, yeah, things are great. Well, doesn't seem like it. And then you find out that this officer has had their life turn into a country and western song at home, or they've got other issues. But luckily, I've had good inspectors, good superintendents who haven't got in the way of that process. And when you raise that this officer is in the weeds and needs time out and needs resources and needs proper care, that has been forthcoming. But it shouldn't be that it's down to individual circumstances and the lucky confluence of a superintendent, an inspector and a sergeant to sort of get it. It should be an everyday business, and I'm sure it still isn't.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you have. I certainly say I've had some line managers that I thought were brilliant, inspirational people. You'd walk through the proverbial fire for them. I've had others that I just think were actually probably worse human beings than many of the violent, awful criminals that I met in the course of being a police officer. And I really do mean it that bad, you know, but most people clearly are not at those extremes. Most people are definitely in the middle. There's a big debate, isn't there, at the moment about whether the police should be involved in responding to mental health incidents. And patients, what I always remember, people who are in contact with mental health services often said, actually, one of the things they value about a police response to their mental health crisis is the fact that the police are not an organization that is forcing them into diagnostic labels or into care pathways. You know, they're human beings who turn up and just treat me with dignity for the time that they need to spend with me. And then, yes, I get pushed off into a system, and the system may or may not be any good for me. But the value of the police response is that you're not the NHS. You're not trying to box me into a label or into a diagnostic framework. You're not trying to push me down a care pathway tube. If you've got this condition, you go down that tube. If you've got that condition, you go down. The police aren't doing any of that. I just value the time that you can spend with me. And actually, that's probably the mantra we need for, you know, supporting colleagues.
Well, I think it might be useful just to, before we go on, just to have a look at some stats that I've managed to get together. And once I started doing the research, I think I've massively underestimated the task in hand. But certainly from what I found, that between 2011 and 22, there was 242 serving police officers and PCSOs, this is England and Wales, that have taken their own lives. 80 further suicides recorded between April 21 and January 24. On average, about 21 officers take their own lives each year, compared to about 16 killed by homicide. And there were over 65,000 sick days were taken for mental health reasons in UK police forces over the past 3 years. It's staggering, isn't it?
And of course, you know, those headline figures kind of hit you between the eyes. But actually, if a chief constable wants to understand that, they need to drill down into the detail of it. You know, what does it mean in their particular force? You know, why are people going off sick? Well, I remember a very senior officer once said to me that as mental health awareness in policing rose, and as it became even more generally socially acceptable to say you were living with a mental health problem, he found that there was, in his own force, there was a drop in the number of bad backs and colds and flu sickness, correlated exactly with an uptake in anxiety, depression, stress related psychological conditions. And his theory therefore simply was that if my colds and back pain are going down and my anxiety and my stress is going up, much of that is going to be simply the preparedness of some to say now what they were unprepared to say 10 years ago. So there could be something here in about, maybe because of all the work that's been done around mental health, some people are now more prepared to go forward and say to their line manager, I'm struggling and here's why, instead of just having a day off saying, oh, I've got a bad back, or a couple of days off saying, I've got a bad back. You know, so maybe there is something in that. But nevertheless, that's why the drilling down is really, really important, because unless you go into it and say, well, you know, which of the, you know, if you've got a police force and officers are off and the numbers seem high, well, what is that about? So how many, for example, are officers under investigation by PSD for stuff that they're just really stressed out about? You know, we know that officers go off work when they're absolutely stressed to the eyeballs with IOPC or professional standards investigations, and how much of it is officers off for other reasons, and is that associated, for example, you know, I remember as a response inspector in my final years of service, I was managing a lot of young people who aren't really earning enough money to exist. You know, we were having a lot of conversations with younger and service officers who were stressed to the eyeballs, because by the time they've paid for their rental mortgage, and then by the time they've paid for their car, which they need to get to work because they're working 24/7, they can't not have a car. By the time they then pay for childcare, if they're married with kids, well, if they have kids, regardless of whether they're married, you know, there's not much money left at the end of the month. In fact, there's probably a lot of month left at the end of the money. If you've got people who are stressed on that front, who are then coming to work, how much does that play into officers feeling that eventually they're going to take time off from work because of stress-related conditions? You know, and it manifests in other ways as well. Like there were conversations in our supervisor office where officers were asking for a little bit of sort of informal advice about whether it would be worthwhile coming out of the pension scheme, because they were desperate for the money that they're paying into their pension and wanted to just talk through the reality of what it would look like if they came out and so on. So we know there are stressors for younger and service officers around things like that. When I usually remember that I'm sitting there as an inspector earning 65 grand and some of these officers who are coming in are earning way less than half of that, I genuinely looked and thought, you know, could I live on half of what I'm currently earning? So, you know, there's lots of stuff that's driving a lot of this. And unless officers, you know, reasons for going off are you know, particularized, and chief officers dig down into it, who knows what they don't know about why their officers are going off. And, you know, it would help them understand what is in my control to do something about and what is not.
Mm. Well, I'm going to think about this and what takes police officers to those very dark places where they're contemplated taking their own lives. And I kind of split it into three kind of themes, really. So you've got the trauma of the job. So that's the incidents that you're actually attending and the distress that that causes. And then you've got the trauma of the organization, which seems to be coming out more and more these days about how people are treated. And then, of course, the trauma of the media, either whether that be mainstream or social media, and the two seem to be more connected than ever. So maybe we could just talk about those three themes.
But I mean, I'd add a fourth one on, if you don't mind, is that the trauma in people's normal lives. A lot of personal life stuff gets difficult and sensitive. Relationship breakdown, financial troubles, bereavement, whether it be of children, siblings, parents, whatever. You know, that's difficult for everybody anyway, all of the time. But probably the four things that you've got there, the cumulative effect of all of that, if you're captured by all of it, who amongst us hasn't ended up connected to something that's ended up in the media as a complaint? Well, I certainly have. Yeah, bereavement, lost both my parents while I was serving. Kind of at an age where you might expect to lose your parents. So genuinely, I was kind of fine with it, but it is upsetting to go through. The other two things you mentioned about the trauma of the job and the trauma of the organization. Yeah, I've seen both of those. Just to give one example, and most officers are going to have this, but because we're doing a podcast, I don't mind disclosing. A few months ago, I was reading the news and I came across an incident where some guy had set fire to himself. And I wasn't expecting to read about this incident. I was just literally, you know, doom scrolling through my phone and reading the news. Come across this incident, how this particular gentleman had ended his life. And I was suddenly transported back to an incident in February 2014 where a guy at work in front of me and two of my officers ended his life by setting himself on fire. And it was probably the single worst thing I saw in my career. I saw plenty of death and guns and destruction and people shot and all the rest of it. But for some reason, watching somebody burn to death was worse than the lot of it. And I found myself 10 years after the fact, and I found myself having a sort of visceral physical reaction. And that's just from one incident for one cop at one point in their career. You know, within a few minutes, I kind of went, oh yeah, fine. You know, I didn't expect that reaction, but you know, I'm fine because it is what it is. It was awful, but it is what it is. How many cops have got countless examples? Because, you know, I was an inspector for most of my career. So actually, I'm not turning up first to most of this horror. You know, I'm the one who walks in calmly when I've already understood in my head what I'm walking into. You know, so I was also conscious as an inspector, I'm kind of 1 or 2 degrees removed from walking into the horror, because by the time the horror's happened and a response car's got there or a sergeant started nailing down the scene or whatever, I know what I'm walking into usually when you go to these things. So if that was my experience, you know, how many times are cops going through things like that where they won't have necessarily what I'll call a flashback, but you just think, oh, right, yeah, I remember that job that was similar to the thing I've just read about or the story I've just seen on a drama on the TV. It's kind of most of those four things that you've listed, most of us have got most of those at some point in time. And if you happen to be unlucky enough to have them all at the same time, well, you know, there's a perfect recipe for people getting their head stuck in a vice, isn't it? And just feeling, you know, is this too much to handle at one particular point?
You've raised a really important point with the example that you've just given, is that the trauma is always there. It never goes away. You learn to live with it. You learn to deal with it.
The job can make it easier. I, through occupational health, ended up in therapy when I was working on the high-tech crime unit. And it was very useful for me and it sorted out a lot of things. But it was a job understanding that there were issues with me, probably caused by the work I was doing, and that I could do with some therapy, which got provided. And I've always been very grateful for that. But it took a particular supervision, understanding there was a problem and doing the right thing about it, getting the right support to me at that time. It was good. Again, it comes back to, it's the right supervision at the right time, doing the right thing. There wasn't much of a process in place that I could see. It was just an ad hoc response to the situation. And we seem sure to process lots of guidance and lots of leaflets and vans going around and things. And when I hit an issue with one of my officers, when I was a frontline sergeant, conscious that there wasn't really much in the way of a process to follow, not even any particularly great guidance. You were just trying to make it up as you went along and doing the best that you could for the officer and trying to get the most that you could for them. It used to be the old manual of guidance where everything you could possibly think about in policing was in a three-ring binder. Well, that's gone. And I was just aware of a feeling as a supervisor that I was having to improvise rather than take proper processes. That's maybe an issue as well, that when it comes to having to be addressed by the organisation, we're not very organised at doing it.
Yeah, and I think certainly in my own force, the offer of support changes over time. Partly that was to do, I guess, with austerity budgets and how much forces can put towards things like external therapy. You know, my force at one point used to fairly easily refer people to at least 6 and easily to 12 therapy sessions if officers had issues. Fast forward a few years after, you know, a lot of the budgetary cuts kicked in and occupational health were having to look at budgets as much as chief superintendents and areas were, and the offer of 6 became difficult to get.
You've highlighted another really important point, is that budgetary costs and the fact that people are only getting a few sessions, they could actually end up being in a worse position than when they started because they've opened up to this trauma, but then that trauma has not been dealt with and taken to a conclusion. They're just kind of left hanging.
Well, I have to say this, in fairness to forces, there is in theory available through your GP as well. You know, it wasn't just a case of, no, you can't have it. It was a case of, you're going to have to go and see your GP to get access to this. And whether that referral can be made through your GP and what the waiting list will be, of course, then that all becomes really difficult. But nevertheless, it wasn't a case of, you can't have it. It was just a case of, well, you can't get it quickly through the job in some cases, because we've had to ration. As all healthcare tends to be, you know, all healthcare everywhere is rationed.
I get that, but I'm fairly militant on this. The old shopkeeper's maxim that if you broke it, you bought it. It's a noble thing that policing will have an effect on your mental health for some people. Just saying, well, austerity and cuts, we can't actually afford to serious effort to put you back together again. That's not sustainable as an argument.
I was going to make the point that while Richard was speaking, that how different policing was when I finished compared to when I started. And, you know, I remember reading, you know, textbooks about policing early in my career. And I did a criminology degree when I was a sergeant, where I had to read even more. And everybody used to talk about the canteen culture of the police and how that fueled misogyny and racism and everything else that's nasty and awful that we need to get rid of. But, you know, the culture of informal support amongst colleagues was very, very different when I joined to later. And there was an element of, we'll go and sit in the canteen, have a cup of tea and talk about things. You know, we'll debrief, if you like. That word debrief was never used, but it's kind of, let's go and talk about that in the canteen, how that job went. There used to be, for good or for ill, there used to be police bars. There used to be places officers would go and socialise at the end of a late shift. If you think sometimes when you're having a bit of a difficult time, don't you sometimes ring your best mate and say, do you want to go to the pub on Friday night? There's an element of how people find coping mechanisms for themselves through their social networks. And I'm not necessarily stressing the alcohol element of that, I'm stressing the socialization element of that in terms of providing a structure or a context or a support that people can draw on if, you know, when the job eventually shows itself to be what it is, which is a really difficult profession that means you're going to see some pretty horrible shit.
You mentioned obviously the bars and the social life after work and all the bad things that came with that. Thankfully, I hope they've gone. But yeah, everything that supported somebody's well-being has now gone. Even the Christmas pantomimes that the families went to.
Gymnasiums in police stations. I know there's, you know, in fairness, I've seen some talk in recent times of some chief constables want to get more gyms back at the police stations. But you talk to medics, nurses, others. Some of the best things you can do for your mental health if you're starting to struggle is exercise. Well, sometimes that's really difficult to fit into shift patterns. For example, the firearms teams in my force, there's plenty of the individuals on those teams would come into work 90 minutes early on a late shift and go to the gym because at that particular point in their day, nothing else is going on with family because the kids are at school or spouses at work or whatever. I'll go in 90 minutes early on every late shift and I'll go to the gym. You know, that was a thing that some of them did. But you've got to have a gym to be able to do that.
Mm. Just going back to the trauma of the job before we move on. And yes, some of the incidents are very unpleasant that we attend. And all normal people probably won't see things like that in their life. And I say normal, and I use that word specifically because that's what we do. We normalize it, don't we, to cope. For me, it was just the sheer relentless workload in the police. It was really difficult to deal with because there was literally no rest. And using I suppose it's a clumsy analogy, but you go to the gym and lift weights. Well, you get strong when you rest, not when you're in the gym. Bring that analogy to police workload. It's just constant.
I certainly found that in the latter period of my service. Really, the longer that I was in service, the heavier the workload seemed to get, just for me, but for my colleague. The number of cases that officers were holding live for investigation has steadily gone up. For a couple of years, I did an ill-advised attempt to play ice hockey. Played for a team who had the team motto, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. It does seem to me there was more fun in the job 30 years ago. That just reduced over time. The amount of time and opportunity to have for it to be a fun job. And the activities around it, as you were saying before, the social stuff, the cohesion, the teams sort of socialising, it's kind of gone. What there is now from officers I've kept in touch with since I've left is the workloads continue to go up. Some of the stuff we've done around automating and IT processes hasn't made the job easier for people, just made it more stressful.
I think it's just allowed the job to give you even more work, to be honest.
I think that's probably right. If the working environment of being a police officer has changed the point where it's far more work than play, and it's all work and no play, that's going to have an effect on the officers overall. Generally, it just becomes a harder job to do and a harder job to stay well while you're doing it. But there's been an increase in the number of suicides, and I don't know, because like you say, the figures are fairly obscure, but it wouldn't surprise me if there'd been an increase in suicides and an increase in the amount of time that people are taking off because they have mental health issues that they can't work with. I think that reflects largely, not that people are getting more fragile, but that the job is getting more better, if you will, making people mentally ill.
I personally don't doubt that's true. I've got no data to prove it whatsoever, but like most people, I can only therefore go on anecdote and experience. And again, if you can stand under the story, I remember some years ago working for a chief superintendent who I found especially difficult. When he moved on to his subsequent role, he was in charge of a department that investigated very, very sensitive public protection matters. I remember a detective in that public protection unit saying that they just didn't have enough time in the week to investigate the workload. It's kind of like if I have to put an hour into every investigation that I've got every week, I only really want about 40 reports, really. But I'm currently carrying about 80, which means that every report can have half an hour of my time a week. Or it means some weeks I focus on half the workload, sometimes I'll focus on the other half next week type thing. And that's not sustainable. The organizational response to that was your workload is the department's workload divided by the number of staff. Well, actually, boss, no, it's not. This person's hired as an employee 40 hours a week. They agree to give you 40 hours a week in return for some money, and they come in to do whatever you give them to do within their remit. Now, they can only do their best within that remit. And if their best is that their 80 investigations get half an hour a week or that aggregated over a period of time, then that's what they get. But if it actually takes an hour a week to provide a good service to those victims who've complained to the police service of something that they've suffered, then that means that the officer now is being put under intolerable pressure to make some decisions. Well, I don't think they're paid enough to take that pressure. The sergeants, inspectors, maybe even the chief inspector, superintendent should be taking that pressure about making prioritisation decisions, because it's not the constable's job investigating the workload to be emotionally responsible for their inability to get the job done because you've given them too much work. I've got more investigations that I have to manage than I have time available to manage them, which then raises the question of overtime. Because if you want to pay me overtime to do the extra work, to an extent, I'd probably welcome the money. Most of us, when we were constables and sergeants, did welcome the chance to do a bit of overtime, but not every day and not for hours and not with loads of cancelled rest days and not forever, because that's not sustainable either. I knew officers who had a sort of standard script that they would type into the computers, and every week it would end up being, I haven't looked at this investigation this week because, and then there'd be a list of reasons. Monday I was asked to deal with a handover and somebody in custody who'd been arrested for an offence. Tuesday I spent all day doing, you know, vulnerable witness interviews, ABE interviews, for a complicated rape investigation. Wednesday I was doing this, Thursday I was doing that. Therefore this hasn't been touched, and my sergeant has been informed. And then they would put the request in for the further deadline on the work on that basis. And it's up to the sergeant whether they then want to acknowledge that kind of write up and manage it or not. But often the answer was not.
I worked for a little while on offender management, managing some fairly risky people that were out in the community. On any given day, we were resourced to perhaps look seriously at three of them. There was two filing cabinet drawers full of files, people. And so on any given day, what we were resourced to do, we did. And you just have to sort of shrug your shoulders a little bit and go, well, if something happens with the other ones we're not looking at, that's just the way it is, because we're not resourced to do more than we can. You know that you're rolling dice in certain departments and hoping that you neglect, because you have to, doesn't go badly wrong whilst you're not looking at it.
So some decisions that I took in my own career were things like, do I want to be working in environments where I have that chronic stress every day of an ongoing workload? Or would I prefer to be working in areas of the police where I go in, do what I can for 8 or 9 hours? Maybe that then some stuff gets handed over to the next team, as inevitably it would. But when I go home, my slate is clean. And I actually found it's a much less stressful way to live, to go in, do your bit, and go home with a clean slate. So, you know, jobs like a custody sergeant, incredibly stressful, difficult, demanding jobs while you're in there. But when you walk out the building, you've handed those prisoners to somebody else. And even if some of the prisoners are still there the next day when you come back in, they're effectively a different prisoner, because you'll have had 16 hours of change in progress. I was a control room firearms commander. I think most forces call it a FIM, albeit my force didn't call it that. The particular force I was in had effectively more firearms incidents than the Met Police, relative to how many commanders there were on duty to manage them. You know, so it was an incredibly stressful job, where sometimes you think, right, you know, three firearms jobs on the go at the same time and a screen full of jobs that need assessing. This is chronic levels of stress. This is I can't get up to go to the toilet stress. But 9 hours, in 9 hours time, or 7 hours time, 3 hours time, I'm going home, and all of that is somebody else's job. And I much prefer that sort of thing personally. And because my brain can tolerate that kind of short-term acute stress and then relax because you can go home now, that was where I ended up choosing to work, because that was how I preferred to be stressed.
And it goes back to what I was saying earlier, and that sort of job, you're quite right, with custody sergeant or force incident manager, you are leaving work behind. But as a line detective or a response officer, you've got your workload in your head, haven't you? And you're thinking about it all the time. People are not putting their workload down, and that is a stress in it of itself, I suppose.
Yeah, and again, you gents being retired, I don't know whether you would agree with this, but I think it's only having stopped by retiring that I then look back and think, I'm amazed that we put up with some of that. I had a real relaxed moment this morning when I was putting the kettle on, where I just thought, you know, I never have to do a night shift again. And all the stresses that come with that, where you have to put your life on pause for a few days because you need to sleep during the afternoon before your first night shift, and then you've got 2 days or sometimes 3 days depending on your shift pattern. That's a stressor, on you know, the mere fact that you have to stay up at night and be awake at the point where you really shouldn't be awake, with all the health implications, not just mental health implications that carries.
I think one thing we can all agree on, it's pretty much every role in policing carries an unusual amount of stress and incidents that can prey on your mind and cause you to have mental health issues. Many people get through it okay. I don't think anybody gets through it unmarked. And we are more willing now to recognise that there are mental health impacts with being a police officer in lots of different roles.
Agreed. Harking back to when I first started writing my blog, I was looking at some stuff about the prevalence of mental health issues in public sector professions. And I found out that police, ambulance and mental health nurses are all roughly 8 times more likely than the working population as a whole to experience mental health problems at some point in their lives. 8 times, like you say, it's a hell of a roll of the dice there, because that means we're knowingly recruiting a bunch of people into policing every month, every few months, whatever it is. And we know a good slice of those people are going to end up struggling with their mental health in some way, shape or form at some point in their careers. Think back to my own stuff around my own resilience, my own well-being, my own awareness of mental health problems and what this job might do to me. There wasn't much of that when I joined, whereas I've been relieved in recent weeks to read that actually forces, at least some forces, are now starting to talk to their officers about the need to take care of themselves, the need not to be too much of a hard lad in your 20s going, no, I'll be fine because I'm hard as nails because I'm Superman in my early 20s. Because you're not always going to be in your 20s and you're eventually going to get old and slow down, and you'll have kids and responsibilities and other things than policing in your life.
Well, that nicely brings us on to the trauma of the organisation, I suppose. And under that banner, I suppose I should look at leadership, positive toxicity, which exists within the organisation, and then obviously professional standards as well. Who wants to start off with that?
There's varying experiences, I guess. I mean, I have been the wrong side of professional standards on a number of occasions, and it's been okay. Again, it's personalities and who's in the chain of command above you and how do they react to it. Now, way back in the midst of time, I was outed as an anonymous police blogger. I was blogging under the name Nightjack, and I had press at the door. I was defending a high court action in privacy. There was a lot of stuff going on. And at the time, I was working on the major investigation team, and the super in charge of that team made a point of coming to see me and literally putting the arm around my shoulder and saying, "They think this is going to be all right, Richard. I think you're still going to have your job on the major investigation team. You know, we'll investigate it and we'll look at it, but I think it's going to be all right." And the amount of stress that simple thing of that super doing, that took off me, because I was entirely unsure what was going to happen. That was very useful. But there was support from the organisation whilst I was going through the process. Now, I think I was lucky. I really do. My experience has not been that the organisation has been as supportive with other officers that I've supervised or worked with that have been under investigation. People get cut from the herd sometimes when they're under investigation. I've seen that happen, and it will make a bad thing worse.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's well known, and you guys know, I was on the receiving end of professional standards as well a couple of times in my career. And, you know, one of them was a highly public thing that got very, very, very difficult and stressful, not least because the fact that I was being investigated hit the national newspapers, and I found myself on the front page of the BBC News website before I even knew what I'd allegedly done wrong. So I was still there scratching my head going, you know, what on earth is it that I've done that means I'm now ending up on the BBC News website and I'm in The Guardian, The Independent, The Mail on Sunday, and I didn't know what it was about either. Of course, I'm racking my brain and going over everything that I think that I've done. Because it being a false account, I thought I was being quite careful, but nevertheless, obviously they feel I've fallen on the wrong side of the line. By Monday morning, my Fed rep rings up professional standards and says, "Would you mind just giving us a clue as to what it's about?" Because he's got no idea, genuinely no idea. And it came back saying, "Oh, well, the notices will get served later in the week. Then he'll know, you know, we'll probably get to interview, you know, maybe next week or the week after." I went in the following afternoon about 3 o'clock, saw the notices. He told me verbally over the phone what it was about. And I genuinely said, "Is that it? Really?" Went in, saw the notices. It was what he said it was going to say, in fairness. And he gave the limited disclosure that relates to it because it's a screenshot of 2 tweets. That's kind of it. Did my interview, finished it. The PSD people who did the interview left the room, and literally 7 minutes later, a superintendent walks in with written advice to give me. And that example, you know, there was nothing in there about welfare. There was nothing in there about, are you okay? How are you feeling about all of this? And I was left there thinking, what the hell are they up to? What the hell are they trying to pull?
Michael, what effect did all that have on you and also your family?
Well, my family were really, really, really worried. My mother in particular had sort of said, you know, you need to get out of that police force. That was her take. And it was difficult because it meant I really struggled to trust the organisation again.
We've got two officers that have both been at the centre of a kind of a social media storm and on the front pages of newspapers and in news reports and stuff. And in one, the organisation seems to have gone out of the way to make it as stressful and unpleasant as possible. And in the other, for myself, they're kind of okay. It was managed. There's no coherence to it, is there?
Yeah, because the only impact for me was the organisation.
I think the police service in general has been historically terrible at dealing with the media. There's been a few high-profile cases recently that I can think of where, on reflection, the police could have done a hell of a lot better in their communication. That's not to say that any investigations weren't up to standard. They were. But their communication about those investigations was pretty poor.
Yeah, and I suppose that, you know, reflecting on Richard's contrast of the two experiences, a bit of me was sitting here thinking, well, I wonder if that's because one force, in my case, had perceived reputational damage to them from the fact that I'm saying the things that I'm saying, whereas perhaps your force didn't necessarily fear as much reputational damage. But then knowing a bit about what you were blogging about, you could imagine some senior officers would be saying, oh, you know, this detective, Nightjack guy, you know, he's saying some stuff that really brings us into disrepute, so hang him out to dry. So it's good. It's good to hear that they didn't. But then, is that personality driven? You know, where officers are subject to that organisational pressure or trauma, as you called it, Dave. The you know, that organisational impact can be considerable for people. And you know, Richard and I both know that personal experience. And it means that organisations do need to be really, really careful about how their policies and programmes then kick in.
Now, it would be really easy for three former police officers to start slanging off leadership. My personal experience is that in the whole, it's been very good. And the reason I mention that is because one of the critical failures in leadership, and I never really thought about it. I was reading a blog from an expert scuba diver who went down to about 60 meters, which is quite deep in scuba diving terms. And long story short, he had an equipment failure and the rest of the team that he was with was all already starting to ascend. And he came very close to drowning. And the point he was making was that the team assumed, because of his experience and expertise, that he didn't need a diving buddy. And there was a phrase that came out of that blog, and it absolutely hit me like a train. Basically, it said, your competence makes you invisible when you need help the most. And I thought, that is absolutely spot on. So if you're seen as a, you know, everybody has a limit, and if you're seen as a good, solid police officer, they automatically assume that you are almost immune to the same traumas that your colleagues will be experiencing.
And it's a good way to think about it. That particular role, the FIM role, called something else where I worked, but that force incident manager role, you know, that's pretty acute. You know, one chief superintendent in my own former force had said that he strongly believes, without a shadow of doubt, that that's the most difficult and demanding and pressurised job in the whole police service because of the inherent gamble that you take every time you sit in the chair as to what you're going to end up managing. The people that tend to get put in those jobs, in my experience, tend to be people who are reliable eggs. You know, they're picked because under pressure, they tend not to break. But that's because the pressure they're sitting under only goes so far most of the time. When eventually something happens where the pressure is just too much for any one human being, that's where, for me, systems and processes have to kick in.
Richard and Michael, we've discovered a lot there, and we're probably going to come back and do some more podcasts on drilling down into some of the things that we've talked about. This is more of an overture, I suppose, to the subject of the rising suicide rates within the police service. So, Richard, then Michael, any final thoughts?
When the job gets on top of you, or when your home circumstances get on top of you, when you're struggling with mental health, it seems to still be a crapshoot, depending on personalities and just a little bit the organisation, but a lot of personalities. And it shouldn't. We spend a lot of time and effort talking about police mental health within police organisations and thinking up ways that we could promote self-care, which is important. But actually, when the wheels come off, we need to be better at making that whole process of looking after the staff member, the officer, to make it more directed and automatic rather than at the whims of fate. And I wouldn't be surprised if the fact that the correlation between perhaps a lack of care and a lack of the arm going round, as I've put it, with people finding it's become too much and either taking their lives or attempting to take their lives. And whether they're guilty or not, it doesn't matter when they're under investigation. It just needs to be an unconditional care and support, or at least the offer of it. If you look yourself in the eye and say, didn't work out well, but I did everything I could think of as a supervisor, as part of the chain of command. But you can say to yourself, well, I gave it my best effort. I did everything I could to help that person. And I'm just not sure. Well, in fact, I am sure that that's not the case across all of the police organisations or even within individual constabularies. That's my take at the moment.
I think what I want to say kind of follows from that a little bit, which is that, you know, we talked about there's four domains, didn't we, of where stresses and difficulties come from that can compound the experience of doing the job and existing in a particular culture, you know, whether it's good or bad, as well as the fact that, you know, officers are people, so they've got all the kind of stuff that happens, like divorce and trauma and bereavement and things in their personal life. Well, there's only a certain amount of that you can control. And something about resilience is about being as prepared as you can be for the stuff that you're going to have to face because you can't control it. And I think if I was to try and convince any young officer joining the police or in the early stages of their career, it would be around making sure you look after yourself and put yourself first instead of the job. And I say that because I was guilty of bleeding blue. You know, that was a phrase used of me by another sergeant when I was a new sergeant, because I would do all the overtime. I would do the double shifts. I'd go home and not have my 11 hours of rest because they wanted you back in for something the next day. All of that's kind of fine. It's got its place. And from time to time, you know, no issues. And I would just say to any young officer starting out, or, you know, young in-service officer, make sure you are looking after yourself. Do the basic stuff right, like the sleeping and the drinking and the eating and the exercise. And, you know, don't underestimate how important that's going to be when you hit 30s and you've got kids, and, you know, when you get into your 40s and you're starting to lose your parents or whatever it is that life's going to throw at you, because you can't control all that stuff. All you can do is be ready for it when it comes. And I think if I could go backwards and take advice for myself, it would be, and I wasn't ready for the battle as much as I could have been, and I should have been better prepared.
Well, Richard, Michael, thank you so much for your time today. I hope people have found the podcast interesting, and I'm sure we will be back again to revisit some of the areas that we've touched upon. So thanks again.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you. And thank you, Michael. Much appreciated.
Cheers. It's
been good.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you both. I've enjoyed it.
DCT Audio. The art of good listening.